Well, welcome to Columbus.
Nice to be here.
A physicist and a novelist, is that like chocolate and peanut butter? Can they go together?
Well, I think that they can. I think everybody has an artistic and a scientific side, or maybe more generally, an intuitive and a rational side. And a lot of us get it drummed out of us when we're very young, but I think it's not really unnatural or uncommon.
You say that even as a youngster you were interested in the sciences and also in literature.
Yes.
Did you find yourself, did you find that unusual?
Well, I found pressures to go one way or the other, either to be the rational kind of person or the intuitive kind of person, because it's not just the profession. Of course, at that age, professions don't really exist. Children don't have professions, but it's a way of looking at the world. And I found that in subtle ways that my friends, my parents, my teachers were nudging me in one direction or the other, as if I would have an easier time through life being either having one type of worldview, the scientific worldview, or the artistic worldview.
It strikes me as a shame that many people tried to box you in.
It is. Well, I don't think it's just me. I think it happens to everybody. And I felt that I didn't want to cut off one piece of myself. I wasn't thinking that concretely at that time, but I just realized that I was started feeling unhappy if I had gone too long without writing a poem, or unhappy if I went too long without doing an experiment, a scientific experiment, that I really found happiness in going down both of those roads.
It seems to me that that's kind of what you're getting at in your teaching at MIT. You're teaching writing to,
yes,
to aspiring to scientists.
Yes. Well, MIT, it's a big secret in the outer world, but MIT actually has a strong program in the humanities and the arts and quite a commitment. And we feel that that scientists and engineers who will be part of our technological culture and the future will shape it need to have understand the human issues with science and engineering and the human concerns. And of course, the arts are important for their own sake as well, but in a largely scientific institution, they have that meaning that they give a full dimensionality and sensitivity to a person who is going to be technical.
You're a novelist and a physicist. You've written about time.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are in James Thurber's house,
yeah,
and one of his most famous quotes that's known by many of us in Columbus is that the clocks I hear are the clocks of Columbus. So, do you have any reaction to that about the way that when he was even away, he was thinking about his hometown and the way we view time? And these are things that you've written about.
Well, is there something special about the clocks in Columbus? Was he using that as a metaphor, or was he being literal about it? Is there a town clock or something like that?
I don't
think
so. I think it was really about him expressing an affinity for his hometown,
yeah,
even when he was in New York,
mm-hmm,
and enjoying success elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I've been a great fan of Thurber's for many years. I love his cartoons. I love his prose writing. I love the collaborations he did with E.B. White, who is another hero of mine and another New Yorker writer. And it's just he has a very unpretentious, unvarnished way of looking at life, which comes out of his drawings and also his writing.
When I imagined that I was going to be interviewing a novelist who was also a physicist, I keep saying this, I thought, aha, I bet it's science fiction. And I read Reunion and I read Einstein's Dream and I said, no, it's not. And then I thought, wait a minute, let me ask him, is this science fiction?
Well, you know, I don't like labels that much. Certainly Reunion, to me, is... has very little science in it. It has a little anecdote about an astronomer at the beginning, but there's not very much science. Einstein's Dreams, I don't consider to be that much about science either, although it uses Einstein as a literary device. I do know that the science fiction community, which is a very tightly knit community, if you know it, it's a cult community, and for some reason it doesn't really mix with the mainstream literature. There are wonderful science fiction books and wonderful science fiction writers. The science fiction community did not like Einstein's dreams. They really did not consider it to be one of their books. So that's as much as I can say about it. I like science fiction very much, as well as many other kinds of genres.
It's, to describe it, it's set in Switzerland as Einstein is about to put his famous theory in the mail, and there are scenarios of different views or possibilities mm-hmm. of time. Mm-hmm. But what you seem to be getting at is the way that we should think of time today. And I take it you think that people believe time is out of their hands, it can't be controlled, it's controlling them, mm-hmm. and that's a viewpoint you would take issue with?
Yes, well, I think there are lots of ways that time enters our life in a practical level and as a metaphorical level, as a psychological level. I think that the time in Einstein's dreams that I was really concerned with was the psychological nature of time. It was not the physicist definition of time. It was the way that we sort of map out our personal identity and our relationship to the world through time. There's another sense in which time enters our lives, and you alluded to it, and that is the way that it controls us. And I think this is an issue that I only lightly touched in Einstein's dreams, but hit it full force in another book of mine called The Diagnosis. And there I was exploring the way that our lives have become more and more scheduled. The pace of life has been increasing. The speed of communication has been ramping up and controlling everything, so that now when we have more than 5 minutes of spare time, we think of some efficient way to use that time. The unit, smallest unit of efficiency, has gotten down to 5 or 10 minutes, and people feel like they're wasting their time if they have 5 minutes or more. And that to me is very worrisome. Just the whole pace of modern life. I think it's part of the fast food mentality. It's part of our loss of values and many other things.
I think a lot of people would agree with that, but a lot of people don't know what to do about it.
Yes, it's very hard to do something about it. I mean, we have jobs that have demands, and it's very hard to do something about it.
And in your case, one of the things you've done about it makes you famous because you don't use email. Do you think it's odd that people know that you don't use email, that that's one of the things that I know about you?
Well, I think it's a little funny at this point. I mean, for many years I've gotten used to getting memos from colleagues where everybody's email address is on it except mine. It says Alan to Alan by paper.
Right.
So I'm sort of a slug. But that's a very, very small way in which I try to resist the onslaught of modern technology.
Let's talk about reunion. In some ways, I think it's talking about the same, mm-hmm. about time also.
Yeah.
Why is reunion such a powerful subject? You know, why does that resonate with so many people?
Well, because I think that every reunion is really a reunion with ourselves. It's a meeting with our younger selves, which I tried to address explicitly in that book, but I think that it's an undercurrent for every reunion. When we go to a high school reunion or a college reunion or a fraternity reunion or whatever reunions that people go to, that we are going back to an early part of our lives. And it almost forces us to evaluate and take stock of where we are, like the midlife crisis, and have we changed since then? I have this theory that our lives consist of 10-year intervals that are pretty much disconnected from each other. I think we become different people. We have new experiences, and we really change. And it's not that easy to relate to ourselves 10 years, 20 years, 30 years ago. And our memory serves its purpose, but memory is a very unreliable thing. And it can be either consciously or unconsciously warped, added on to, subtracted from, distorted. And so it's like we have a lot of 10-year segments of ourselves, and how do we connect all of those pieces together to come up with a single coherent identity?
In Reunion, Charles attends his reunion and he's transported back to when he was a college student. And the reunion's not about his interaction with the other people at the reunion, although there's some of that. And that was kind of the expectation about a reunion novel. But it's actually, as you say, it's his re-examination of his younger self. And in the book, he'll tell a story one way, and then he'll correct it another way because he can't remember correctly. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. That was my sense of what was happening there.
I wondered about that as I read it. I said, well, why is he telling this a different way? Why didn't he just write it one way the first time? But you wanted to show that mm-hmm. our grasp of memory and time is elusive. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't think that he really knew exactly which version of events occurs out of the several different versions that he would be presented with or remember for a given thing. I don't think that he knew. And I didn't know as the writer which of them was the actual event.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned that I thought even this book was almost science fiction in a way, because I think the way that he's transported in the past so completely and seamlessly in the book, he's gazing at a model of the campus as he remembers it, and he actually sees himself in a classroom and he's in the past totally.
Yes. Well, see, if this had been science fiction, I would have had some scientific device which transported him to the past, like in H.G. Wells, The Time Traveler. He would have gotten to some machine that had magnetic magnets and coils, or something like in Carl Sagan's Cosmos, this machine that Jodie Foster gets into. So I think that what distinguishes it from the traditional science fiction is that he didn't get into such machine, that he was just transported through his own memory.
Why did you pick that as the trigger to his past, that model, instead of a painting, a smell, or?
It could have been any of those things. I don't know mm-hmm. how the creative imagination works. The painting or the smell might have served as well. The model, the campus model, gave me an opportunity to describe the campus, and it was a way in, but I think that a painting or a smell might have worked just as well.
So in the first part of the book, before he's transported, it's told in the first person, and when the point of view changes immediately,
yes.
Why did you want to do that?
Well, I wanted the reader to be clear that that one set of events were remembered events and one were present events. I mean, that was one way to do it. I also think, of course, that there's a vast difference in the literary effect of first-person stories and third-person stories, and I can't quite put my finger on all the many differences, but I know that I once wrote a novel, Good Bonito, and I wrote it all in the first person. And after I read it in draft form, and I do a lot of drafts, it struck me as a diary, and that was not the effect that I wanted. So I said, well, I'll just rewrite it in the third person. I'll go to my laptop and I'll just do a search, and everywhere I have the word hi, I'll put he,
right,
just to search substitute pronouns. And I found that didn't work at all, that there were many, many changes I had to make in going from first person to third person. And so it really is, there's a lot of sort of literary machinery that goes into that, and the feeling that the reader has as well. So I can't really explain more than that because I don't understand it completely. But to me, it felt right to have the older narrator telling things in the first person and the past being narrated in the third person.
One of the things I think it allows, it makes it clear for the reader when the protagonist is commenting on his youth.
Yes.
So he'll remember an incident and tell that one way, and then the voice changes. He just says, "Oh, I can't believe I did that." You know.
That's right.
Is this the same? Am I the same person that this child was?
Yes. That's.
It makes that clear to the reader.
Yes, that's a very good point. Yes, you're right.
That strikes me as almost something out of Dickens when Scrooge is looking at his past lives. Were you thinking of Scrooge at all? And in fact, there was a line in there that I underlined, and it sounded like it was right out of Scrooge, that I was terrified by what I saw or something like that.
Well, I've read Dickens. I wasn't thinking consciously about Dickens, but that doesn't mean that I wasn't influenced. I think that when we write and even when we read, that we are influenced by everything that we've written, that we've read before that, as writers or readers. That may have been an influence.
Mm-hmm. You've written, or you've said in interviews, that you have books that you read over and over again that you return to.
Yes.
What are some of them?
Well, a book that I have read a number of times is Franz Kafka's The Trial. I think it's an amazing book. It's non-traditional. I've read a couple of Italo Calvino's books over several times. I've read The Magus by John Fowles several times. I think I would profit by reading many books over more than once, because I think when we read a book twice, separated by a number of years, that we've changed and we get something different out of the book. And that's the wonderful thing about fiction, that it's not like a scientific treatise where everything is supposed to be completely understood on the first reading. That when we read a novel, that we bring to it our own life experiences, and when those experiences change, we see the book differently. So I think every novel is not completed until it's read by a reader, and every reader completes a novel in a different way, and not only that, but a different way if they read it at different times in their lives.
Early in the book, Reunion, the protagonist is watching a news report of an earthquake, I think, in Honduras, and he sees the victims on TV, but he says they're not real to him.
Mm-hmm.
There's no traction there. If he were reading of those victims, would that be more of a connection for him?
It might be. Yes, if you were reading and having time to reflect about them, if you were reading a good piece of writing about them, but the news is presented to us in sort of micro bits and little flashes, and there really isn't any context of reflection around that frequently, not always, but frequently. I think that's why he feels that he's not connecting to it.
Well, let's return to time, and I'll have you put on your scientist hat again.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason to feel hopeful about time? When I was a child, they told us we'd all be working 4 days a week, we'd have more time on our hands,
yes,
and that technology would free us.
Yeah.
And many people would say the opposite has happened.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can we be hopeful or encouraged about time, or is there something we can do about time in our lives?
Well, the trend, I don't see much possibility for the trend to reverse itself. That when we have gotten more efficient in our production, which has happened, efficiency is almost double since 1950, that instead of using that increased efficiency to reduce the work week, we have just increased the total production, and actually the number of hours worked per week has increased on average since 1950 across all income levels. I don't see that trend reversing. I think that in order to create time in our lives, that we're going to have to do it away from the workplace, and we're going to have to decide to turn off our cell phones at certain times, not take our laptops with us on vacations, and create spaces of stillness and silence in order to reflect and think about who we are and where we're going. So I think we're going to do that person by person away from the workplace. Each individual is going to have to decide what his or her priorities are and make time and space.
Thank you for this opportunity. It's fascinating.
Wonderful to be here in the Thurber House, and nice to talk to you, Brett.